You're listening to Classic Movies Live, the pre-recorded show where we have a mission here to talk about every movie that's ever come out. And if you also have this mission, you should stop now, because it is literally impossible. Do you know how many movies come out every single year? I want to say 100, but I would be drastically underestimating. I think if you even have the idea to watch every single movie that comes out in a single year, you are going to be doing so at the expense of your family, your friends, your job, your hobbies. It will consume you. Like vengeance consumes Batman, which is what we are talking about today. Today we are talking about a verified, certified classic, Batman, Mask of the Phantasm. This is a movie about vengeance. This is a movie about how vengeance can consume you, about how a singular passion, let's call it, can eat up everything else in your life and can really, you know, turn you into something you may not even recognize, but that it also may become too late to go back from. This movie is one of very, very few Batman, animated Batman movies released in theaters. To my knowledge, it is only one of three with a wide release, those being Batman Mask of the Phantasm, the Lego Batman movie, and Batman the Killing Joke. And this was released in 1993, right between two live-action Batman movies. Actually, right between a Tim Burton live-action movie and a Joel Schumacher live-action movie. Which is, you know, an interesting tidbit that we don't really touch on too much. But that little bit of context can be quite interesting to analysis, I think. I think you may find that interesting. That's why I said it. We are going to talk a little bit of spoilers. We do give a spoiler warning. So for those of you who have not yet seen this movie, you will know when to exit our conversation. That said, this movie, not terribly hard to find. In Canada, it is currently on Crave. I assume in the United States, it is currently on HBO Max. You should check it out if you can. It is also very short for a movie. It is 76 minutes. And our episode today, if we've done our jobs right, should clock in at about 56 minutes. So, you know, we're very close to being a audio commentary of the movie. Not quite, but we do actually bring that up at one point. So, you know, check out our episode after you've watched the movie. It'll keep you busy while you sort of sit with what you have just watched. So, you're going to hear the Batman Mask of the Phantasm theme coming up right now. This theme is, of course, composed by Shirley Walker. Here it is. Batman Mask of the Phantasm. Welcome back to another episode of Classic Movies Live, a pre-recorded show where, over the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about classics, and, you know, maybe my perception is off, but I get the feeling that when we talk about classics and we don't have a guest,
it's often whatever I thought was a classic, and let's do that one. And hopefully I'm like just being a little too critical of myself here. But the whole thing that I am trying to get to is very rarely, and not intentionally, but very rarely have we picked a Pierre classic. And Pierre, I think we've done that today.
We have. I don't know. I guess I very rarely think of movies to talk about, to be honest. Especially like, I don't think there's too many movies where I'm like, that's an instant classic, you know? Mm-hmm. I also think it takes like years for me to like truly build up that feeling, if that makes sense. But yeah,
there's a few that you've mentioned that I don't think we certainly haven't gotten around to all of them, but you've mentioned a few here and there. It feels like the maybe not the conclusion of this series, but definitely like at some point we got to talk about The Dark Knight, because I think you've brought that up at least once per season over the
Well, yeah, that's fair. That's the movie that like got me into like being more of a movie fan. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I feel like it's common for a lot of people. It's like the, I don't know, like the jumping off point between blockbuster viewer and I guess movie fan, if that makes sense. That and like, I'd say it was The Dark Knight, and then I watched Inception right after, because I was like, oh, that's Christopher Nolan. I want to see what else he did. And Inception's also a great blockbuster movie that really, I think, teaches you a lot about the finer details of movie making as well. So Christopher Nolan, great, I guess, converting movie fan conversion person. Does that make sense?
I mean, kind of. I mean, we'll get to it when we eventually talk about The Dark Knight, but I think The Dark Knight is actually, you know, as someone who initially didn't love it as much as a lot of other people, I think that was also like a big turning point for me in, you know, going from just a casual movie watcher to thinking more deeply about stuff. I like wrestled with that movie for a while. And then Inception, I guess I would have seen Inception after. I think Inception came after The Dark Knight.
I think it was his next movie. After.
Yeah. I think Inception might have been my first Blu-ray that I ever owned.
Wow.
I had lots of DVDs before, but that was my first Blu-ray.
Well, when did Blu-ray become a thing? Was that 2007? Like when the PS3 came out?
I
want to
say 2008 or 9.
Wasn't it?
Like, okay. I don't think that The Dark Knight released initially on Blu-ray. Like, I think that was a DVD first.
You know what? I think, because have you seen Tropic Thunder?
I have.
Remember there's that really long montage scene where Jay Baruchel is discussing why the Blu-ray beat the HD DVD in to the group and no one's listening, and it's like he's explaining it's because the porn industry adapted Blu-ray or something like that.
Vaguely, yeah.
And yeah, and that movie came out in 2008, and I'm guessing it was shot in 07. So I guess it was probably around then.
Maybe Blu-ray was like 2006 then.
Yeah, I'm using Jay Baruchel to date and the technology changes in our lifetimes.
I think he's a good metric of it. He's sort of put himself out there as the dated technology guy.
I mean, yeah, he helped us navigate the BlackBerry life cycle too. So, you know, he's got a knack for it. But we are talking about Batman. And yes. Is there a movie specific? We're not talking about The Dark Knight today. That is not what Jeff was saying.
We'll get there. We'll get to The Dark Knight. That's probably a longer episode. We got to have some time for that one.
For sure.
Whenever that comes up. But today we're going to talk about a movie which is one of, I think, only three Batman movies to get like a wide theatrical release. And one of only like a hand. Animated, yes. One of only three animated Batman movies to get a wide theatrical release. I think one of only, like, maybe five to get any kind of theatrical release at all. And it's the first one. It's Batman Mask of the Phantasm. Now, Pierre, I have to ask, did you go to see this in theaters?
I was not alive.
I wasn't alive when this came out in theaters, so...
Good, okay. I was worried I'd have
to... Oh, wait, no, I was alive!
Oh, never mind.
I really missed out. I should, at 9 days old, I should have convinced my parents, hey, why don't you fly across the Atlantic Ocean really quick and go see Batman, please?
Specifically because it's actually a really dark movie for kids. I don't even know if I'd take like, even like a 5-year-old to this, to be honest.
I don't know. I don't think it's inappropriate for kids. It's dark for kids.
Definitely
it's
not inappropriate. There's nothing, there is implied death, though, I think. I believe.
A couple of times, yeah.
Yeah.
Not even...
No, it's not implied. It is... they do die, never mind.
It is technically implied in that you don't see an on-screen death, but, like, there's one scene where you see a guy go, like, oh, no! And then a statue falls on him, and the next thing you see is the statue falling on him. Like, right. You don't see a crushed body with blood all over the place.
You see, I think they cut away to someone gasping.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that he dies.
Yeah. And, or Saul Valestra? Was he dead before the explosion, or?
Oh, yeah, Saul Valestra, I just straight up see his body.
Yeah, I can never tell with the Joker gas, so if they're, like, already dead, or they're, like, basically, like, brain dead or something, I don't know. I mean, and then he explodes, so he was definitely dead by that point.
Yeah. So,
yeah. But yeah, so this was, I think, this was made by the same creative team as the animated series, and mm-hmm. obviously a lot of the art and I think story is, like, taken, like, it's seen as a continuation of the animated series, but it's also, like, its own separate thing that I don't know is, I think it's technically part of canon because... what's her name shows up in Batman Beyond, the Phantasm, who...
Oh, okay.
A cameo, and that's also by Paul Dini, or Bruce Timm. So I think it's technically canon. I don't know where it fits in the canon, to be honest.
I mean, the thing about the Batman the Animated Series, too, is the canon is fairly loose. Like, the way that cartoon is built up, it's as... Basically... Most episodes stand on their own. So, like, there are overarching plots and stuff, but, like, you know, where does this fit between Heart of Ice and the trial? It's somewhere in there, for sure. It doesn't really matter as much.
Yeah, I've honestly never really watched the animated series. I think I've seen a couple episodes. I always heard it was, like, amazing, but I'm gonna be honest, watching it as an adult, it definitely seems pretty kiddified.
I mean, it is. It's for children. Yeah.
No, I know, but, you know, there's some shows. I'm trying to think of a show where I've... Okay, maybe not. I'm trying to think of an example of a show that I didn't watch as a kid, and it was, like, a block, like, an action kid show, but I watched as an adult, and I was like, oh, that's actually, like, pretty mature for its age. But, yeah, all the shows I've rewatched have been shows I watched as a kid, so I think it's hard to clarify.
I remember watching Justice League and Justice League Unlimited when I was in university, and, like, a lot of the episodes, I mean, it's obviously a kid's show. Like, a lot of the episodes are, there's a lot of episodes that are, like, you know, just kind of villain of the week, fun stuff. But then every now and then, and I think that's a lot of the appeal of some of these shows. Every now and then there's an episode that's like, oh my God, that's an incredible episode of television right there. And, like, you know, Batman the Animated Series has a couple of those. Batman the Brave and the Bold has a couple of those. They have, you know, each of those series that I mentioned has, like, between 40 and 120 episodes. So, like, there's all manner of quality in between there. But every now and then there's, like, one or two that make you think, oh, I'm really glad I watched this series.
Yeah, I did watch a bit of Unlimited, I think. That one actually I remember being... pretty, I think, a little more advanced story. It felt more like for teens than kids.
Yeah.
Whereas the animated show or Batman the Animated Series definitely felt like more kids level. But I think it sometimes it confused me because when I've seen I don't know if you've seen Batman Beyond Return of the Joker.
I think I have way back in the day. Batman Beyond is something I watched as a kid. So, like, I haven't seen much Batman Beyond since then. But I think I watched Return of the Joker at some point. Yeah, I remember it being very strange. Like,
yeah,
Batman Beyond...
that's a very, very dark movie.
Yeah.
But it also has a flashback to the animated series era. And that whole flashback is really dark too. So I think like when I first watched the animated series when I was older, I was expecting like a similar vibe, but no, it's definitely, like you said, kind of a more of a serial adventure of the week type of show.
But also something that's kind of interesting is all the ones that I've mentioned so far. So like Batman, the animated series, I didn't mention this one, but Superman, the animated series, Batman Beyond, Justice League and Justice League Unlimited, and maybe Batman, the Brave and the Bold. I don't think the Brave and the Bold, but all five of those were made by Bruce Timm and Paul Dini as like the main like creative people behind the scenes. And so Batman, the animated series was the first one. But like where you're saying Justice League Unlimited was more for teens, Justice League Unlimited was also about 15 to 20 years after Batman, the animated series. I think they're very conscious of the fact that at least part of their audience is growing up alongside these movies or these shows. Like, I don't think that they're making Justice League Unlimited for 25-year-olds, but like... That's true. Some of the people who are watching Justice League Unlimited were watching reruns of Batman the Animated Series 10 years ago. So, like, you know, they went from 5 years old to 15 now. They are more teens.
Yeah, that's true. And, I mean, you could even argue, I feel like the Arkham video games were, like, a spiritual successor in some ways. Mm-hmm. And those were even more matured and, I guess, brutal to watch. Or not watch, play.
Those were even more for teens.
Yes, exactly. More teens. But yeah, so, but it is crazy that, you know, going back to Phantasm, I do think this was kind of their best work, even though, you know, like canonically it's hard to tell how, where it stands. And there's so many things that I think it adds to the Batman lore that, like, because I don't know if the animated series ever got into his origins or even like Justice League or anything. But, you know, this kind of gives us a sort of origin story for the animated series Batman. And it actually gives, like, probably by far the best Bruce Wayne Batman movie, if that makes sense, that I've seen. It really utilizes Bruce Wayne as a character. You know, I think, like, The Dark Knight, obviously, usually seen as kind of the Batman movie. But Bruce Wayne is definitely... as a person kind of on the sidelines because he's dealing with, I mean, even just like compared to the rest of the cast is insane. There's so many things going on. Bruce Wayne is more of a, I would say kind of a plot device in terms of he's kind of conflicted between retiring and being just Bruce Wayne or really committing to Batman and seeing and letting go of Rachel. If that makes sense. And that's kind of where Bruce Wayne comes in rather than him really evolving himself as a character. Whereas this movie, we get into kind of a lot more of the guilt. And I would say like we see Bruce in kind of this almost purgatorial state where he's stuck. He feels stuck with having to not be happy, essentially. And he almost sees Batman as kind of his burden, his punishment for letting his parents die. And in this movie, we see him finally have a reason before he becomes Batman to maybe have lived another life and been okay with being happy and finding another way to, I guess, honor his parents' death, if that makes sense. And that's by far the most interesting thing I've seen from any Batman movie about Bruce, and it really makes me sympathize with him much more as a character than any other, I guess, medium I've seen Batman in, to be honest.
I think I when I look back on the Chris Nolan Batman movies, and the thing is I haven't seen them in so long that probably my opinions on them are actually just like completely wrong at this point. But I've always thought that like those Chris Nolan Batman movies, the villains are way more interesting than Bruce Wayne himself. And like Bruce Wayne works in there. Bruce Wayne and Batman are in that. And they help like, you know, through the villains, Christopher Nolan is saying something interesting and Bruce Wayne and Batman being against those villains, like makes whatever Chris Nolan is wanting to say kind of work because like you have, you know, you can't have, I mean, I guess you technically can. Maybe I'm picking the worst example here. You can't have a Joker movie without the Batman. But the whole thing I'm saying is that, like, what's interesting about Heath Ledger's Joker works because the Batman is there to, like, basically yes-and him, kind of. Yeah. And, you know, like I'm saying, I haven't seen those movies in a while. My opinions on those are probably at least a little bit out of date. But I think there's like this, and I know there's this meme of like, I mean, or I guess it's a meme at this point of like Bruce Wayne is the mask and Batman is the person. And I think that the movies that like the best Batman stories, and this I guess goes for a lot of other heroes as well, are the ones that like just don't indulge that meme. Like in Mask of the Phantasm, Bruce Wayne is a person and Batman is an alter ego for that person. It's not like Batman is the real one and Bruce Wayne is the mask. This is a movie about him. Like, I guess if you wanted to like indulge that meme, it's like, it's about him having to choose which is the real him. And I think that it's, it gets really interesting because this is a movie that like fully treats Bruce Wayne as a human being that has to, you know, make a decision. There's one moment in this movie that's like really heartbreaking. It's the first time, at least in the movie, in the context of what's going on, it's the first time he puts on the Batman cowl. And it's really heartbreaking because it's like, it's kind of like a part of him is dying when he's just, you know, in context, technically, I guess he's just going out to do his job now. But like a part of him is fully dying in that moment, which is really sad. And this movie, you know, gets to the heart of that really well.
Yeah, I love how that it's almost played like a horror movie moment when Alfred sees Bruce with the cowl on for the first time. And it does feel like the ultimate. I don't know. It's like even this man who's like seen Bruce grow up his whole life, he's like probably the closest thing to family Bruce has, or he is family. And he was scared by Bruce putting the mask on because he kind of sees like, you know, the ultimate transformation that he's made here. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I guess we never talked about what the movie's about. So do you want
to? Yeah, sure. It's actually like shockingly straightforward. It's Batman. He's in Gotham City like he always is. And someone is going around in a spooky costume that kind of looks like Batman's. And he's going around killing gangsters. And specifically, over time, it turns out that the gangsters he's killing are all from this one like small family that had some dealings with the Beaumont Corporation. And at the same time, the heiress of the Beaumont Corporation, Andrea Beaumont, comes back to Gotham City and meets up with Bruce Wayne, who is an old flame. They used to go out and they almost got married, but it didn't work. And so, yeah.
You make it sound it didn't work.
And now many years later, Bruce Wayne has to once again battle with his feelings of like being Batman and, you know, doing the job that he's put himself into, which is catching this villain. And also trying to figure out what Andrea's up to because they used to go out and it didn't work.
You make me not want to watch them.
But the movie is very much like, it's really interesting because it is a romance story. It's two things. It's a romance story and like a noir mystery. So many Batman stories are noir mysteries. He lends himself so well to that genre. But within that, there's also this old romance between Bruce Wayne and, you know, someone else, Andrea Beaumont, very, very early into his career as Batman, where he is still deciding whether or not he wants to do this. And so that romance sort of, it presents an alternate life path for him. The real beauty of this movie is that there's the implication of a Bruce Wayne that never was, but that could have been. And then there's, you know, the ultimate, not even reveal, but the ultimate, like, story tragedy of the Bruce Wayne that actually is. And so that dichotomy is at the center of this movie, and it's really just a character piece. Like, plot wise I think I described everything, but you know, around that plot, just the way that mystery unfolds and the way that romance plays out says a lot about Bruce's character in a way that, you know, not every Batman story is interested in doing. A lot of Batman stories are about the world's punchingest detective, and this one is, you know, about who this person is under the mask.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, I think, first of all, like, I feel like it's very rare for me to be invested in, especially like an animated romance, mm-hmm. and like see like chemistry popping between animated characters. But like Andrea Beaumont's like, she's such a great foil for Bruce and an amazing character that honestly she doesn't really get, she gets like 5 minutes of screen time, but just instantly like you can understand why I guess they connect so well, you know. They have like they have just great like comedic chemistry. They have a very similar past. They seem to be grieving in similar ways about, you know, their parents and their efforts to move on or heal and while still respecting their parents, you know.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, I think she's still like my favorite love interest for Bruce that I've seen in any movie. I mean, part of me is sad like it never kind of has come up in other movies, though I will say I think there's like rumors Scarlett Johansson might be playing her in the Batman 2. I think that's a long shot, but I really hope that's true. But yeah, like I think that was so essential to making this movie work too, especially for such a short runtime, you know, like this movie does so much. And even like telling Bruce's origin, having that romance play out, and then also in the background you kind of see the downfall of like of Gotham and how, you know, and all the flashbacks we're getting, this like obviously things aren't perfect, but they're using brighter color palettes, they're using the city just seems more vibrant, and we have this really cool setup of, you know, the City of the Future Expo that they're touring around, you know, and everyone's imagining what Gotham might look like 10, 20 years in the future, and then we see what it's like in the present, you know. It's, it hasn't become that. We get
actual Gotham is the same, and the City of the Future has fallen into extreme ruins. Like, it's actually, you may go in there and I'm like, why is this place still standing?
Exactly. Yeah, and it's so symbolic of, I guess, not just like Bruce's, it's symbolic of like Bruce's future, Gotham's future. It's just so many things with those flashbacks, which is just like such efficient storytelling. And it also gives us an amazing set piece too at the end of the movie. But having I guess Bruce struggle between, because I think he would never have become Batman if Andrea didn't leave, right? I think that's like what he proposed to her and everything.
That's certainly the implication.
Yeah, and learning that it's almost like when the last chance he had was just like literally taken away from him. He was almost forced to become Batman. Was just such a cool choice, and especially that scene where he's standing in front of his parents' tombstone and like kind of begging them to let him be happy is such a powerful moment. That, like, that's, I don't know, that's just etched in my brain, and it's just a great, sounds mean, but it's a great Bruce Wayne moment. I'm not gonna lie.
We get a lot of I mean, obviously we get a lot of Bruce Wayne's psyche in this, but just in Kevin Conroy's performance, there's so many like little touches that he brings in that are so good. I mean, from Kevin Conroy and also partially from the animators, like one scene that really sticks with me is maybe the one you were talking about, but there's two scenes where he's in front of his parents' grave, and the one that I'm thinking about, I think, is the one you just mentioned, where he's like begging his parents to be happy, to let him be happy, and then there's like a lightning strike and you see this imposing shot of his parents' grave, and it's like, yeah, but he's imagining that, like, not, he's imagining it in that way, like, yes, there he is in fact in front of a very big gravestone, but like his parents are dead, they're not telling him anything. This vow that he's made to his parents is not something they actually care about. That is entirely self-imposed. And like the intimidation of it comes from the fact that it is self-imposed. I mean, his parents died when he was so young that everything since then, his entire, like his parents that he's built up in his mind at this point in his life are fully a fantasy. Mm-hmm. Like they only scare him because he has made a version of them that scares him, which I think, like, I just spent a minute and a half talking about a 2 second scene.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, it's a powerful scene. Like, I mean, like what you say about the self-imposed thing is what makes it so, like, I love the, like Bruce is essentially projecting his feelings of guilt onto his parents. Like they won't let me move on. Essentially, I have to do this for them, you know? becoming Batman, I don't think is inherently something he wants to do at all.
No.
But I think he subconsciously kind of wants to, because
yeah,
he's telling himself his parents want him to do it.
I was going to say, maybe inherently isn't the right word, because it is actually inherent to him that he wants to become Batman.
Yeah.
Despite, but like actively, his like real brain is like, no, I don't want to do this, except he kind of does.
Right, yeah. It's like his conscious and his subconscious are both fighting and he doesn't even know it.
But then there's that interesting like connection too with Andrea. We later learn, and I guess this is spoilers, so spoilers here. We later learn that her father has also died. Like, most of her backstory involves, you know, her having to deal with her father's legacy. But throughout the movie, we are led to believe that he's still alive somewhere, just in hiding. Mm-hmm. And then we learn that, in fact, he's not. And him dying is also the thing that, like, switches her over to this path of vengeance. So I think that's, I don't know, we don't get as much of that because that is sort of revealed as a twist. But it basically ends up being, for both of them, this moment in time, the point where Bruce proposes to her, is this alternative path that they could both take. And they end up not taking that, but then they also end up in like a little bit of a roundabout way, both going down the same path of vengeance.
Yeah, I guess I never really thought about like, yeah, that her dad being the last straw. Yeah, because we see most of the movie, She still has her dad. Her mom's dead. We don't know why. I guess now in hindsight, it might have been for more dark reasons than like we might realize, considering her dad's affiliation with the mob.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like, yeah, losing her dad, and I guess also like losing her potential at a life with Bruce. She, because I think she kind of frames it that way. Like, I think she says at the end, it's like, look what they took from us, the life we could have had.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is that this is also she's self-imposing this on herself too, because she's like, her and Bruce definitely obviously are like, seem to be like soulmates in my opinion. Like they both have that connection even in the future, right? 10 years later or whatever. And and she's projecting her inability to be with Bruce onto the mob. And she's saying it's their fault. Where in the end, it's because subconsciously she feels like she can't be with Bruce, I think, as well, because of the pain she's going through.
Yeah, because when she says, look what they took from us, literally the day before they were together and could have dropped everything. They actually could have. The last bits of the movie wouldn't have happened if they had both just left town that day. And they're rich enough they could do that. Like, I'm not saying that's certainly not where the story was going, but like everything that they are projecting onto other people, they actually could just, you know, choose to break the cycle right there. They have the means, they at least consciously have the will to do it, but they're just not doing it because, you know, there's all this other stuff that is weighing on them and they are finding scapegoats for it, basically.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's that great when they first see each other again. They both, I think Bruce says, still taking daddy's orders, I think he says. And then she says, the only person I see controlled by their parents in this room is you. And they're literally both just calling each other out for exactly what they're going through.
Yeah.
Which also, I think, points out to how well they work together.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, that last scene where her and Bruce kind of reconcile. Yeah, it's such a, it's like a high point in what is usually the low point in a movie, if that makes sense. Like, that's the end of the second act before she goes to face the Joker. And ironically, that's like, I think the happiest maybe part of the movie. And I think that's interesting. It's an interesting parallel. I guess we haven't talked about the Joker yet, which is kind of crazy. He only comes in like halfway through the movie, but I also think this is like my favorite Joker performance / I guess character work, if that makes sense.
Mm.
I think he's a great mixture of the fun, goofy Joker from, you know, the animated series mixed with like, you know, the darkness that only a theatrical release of this Joker could bring, if that makes sense. I mean, there's so many other great Joker interpretations, but they usually just veer too light or too dark, in my opinion. I think this is just a great mixture of both,
and Mark Hamill's, I think, kind of like in his prime here.
And he's speaking. Really funny. I know you've kind of like hinted at that, but he actually is like so he's so funny in this. He says at one point, like he's trapped Andrea and he kicks her out a window and then he goes, "Are you ready to meet your biggest fan?" And then he turns on this comically large fan that she's gonna get sucked into.
Yeah, and it's also like it's a horrifying way to die. Like it's actually like very practical too.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, like, you know, when you watch, like, the movie version, I like the live-action versions of Joker, and they usually go darker. There's no, I guess, unpredictability. There's less unpredictability, if that makes sense. Like, when you see Heath Ledger's Joker for the first time, you're not like, oh, I wonder if he's secretly, like, maybe a funny guy, like a nice guy, you know?
Yeah, he's not secretly a nice guy, but Heath Ledger's Joker is notable partially because he is very funny.
Right, but he's not goofy, I wouldn't say.
Yeah, Jack Nicholson is closer to goofy.
True, that's I haven't seen that movie in a long, long time, so maybe I have to rewatch that in order to re-rank my favorite Joker. But this Joker, I think my biggest, what I love so much about him is you never know from like moment to moment in any of his scenes is he going to think this is all funny to him or is he going to become murderous? Like, I think, or both, you know, like, I think that scene, his first scene, God, I love every scene. He's actually like, it's such a standout, but the Sal Villestra scene where he's basically joking around with Sal. And honestly, to me, he doesn't seem violent at all or very interested in Sal in general. And then Sal touches him and then he gets really angry. And then he plays it off as a joke and Sal's like, oh, he's just back to like, you know, the chill Joker that I was just talking to a minute ago. And then Sal dies. I love how like part of me during the movie is just like, oh, I'd love to almost like hang out with this Joker. He seems like a fun guy.
And then Sal touches him and he gets so angry that like the background of the animation changes to pure red.
Right. Which I feel like is a very corny, but honestly works so, so well for me. And that moment is also very etched in my head.
It's a crazy effect.
Yeah.
Like it's like a 2 second thing. Cause it's just quickly they fade out into red and then it goes back to normal.
Yeah.
But
I mean, it kind of puts you in Sal's head too, because he looks very relieved after the red is gone. The Joker kind of seems like back to his goofy self.
Mm-hmm.
And then he dies. So, yeah. I mean, yeah, every scene, like that whole scene with the councilman. I also, that scene where Sal, when we find out Sal dies and Joker's voice comes out over the camera, the first time I saw that, I got like so many chills. It was such a, I don't know, like it's a scene like that also kind of reminds you how like smart Joker is, you know, and when the phantasm goes against him. He realizes she realizes in a way how out of her depth she is, because she, like, I don't think anyone understands how the Joker works other than Batman.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be up against him and realize he's actually one step ahead the whole time was a really cool way of kind of reminding us that Joker is kind of the ultimate threat. Like he's almost, I mean, we mentioned this last week, but he feels very much force of nature in this movie.
Yeah,
it's all the other characters, because when he comes in, the plot shifts instantly and seems like all the characters start to revolve around him once he decides to enter the fold, if that makes sense.
And it shakes up the emotional core of this movie, because he doesn't care at all about whatever's going on there. Like maybe he does as a viewer a little bit, but like that's just not his aim. So like now there's like extra stakes in the emotional core of this movie. Because, you know, Batman and the Phantasm are still working with that.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they have to deal with the Joker, who's just in there to stir shit up.
Right. Well, I mean, he did, I guess it is implied he actually did kill Andrea's dad.
Yes.
Which I don't fully, I mean, I think it's like necessary to bring him into the story. And he has to be kind of the ultimate, like, it makes sense. I guess plot-wise, like to have him be the ultimate villain that Andrea can't beat, and she kind of needs Bruce for that, because again, he's the only one that kind of gets Joker. But then also, yeah, it does feel like a very much like a small world moment where like it's like, oh, so Batman's arch nemesis is also the guy that ended up killing Andrea's dad, his main love interest. Like that feels a little too convenient.
But I also kind of didn't feel like Andrea, like she, like he was on Andrea's radar before that, because like she went after Chucky Saul, then she went after Buzz Bronski. Mm-hmm. And then she went after Sal Valestra, and like when Sal was meeting with the Joker, he was like, you know, you're next. I never believed that. To me, it felt like Andrea was like probably done after Sal, because even in the flashbacks we get, the Joker is never that, he's never really there, except in the very last one where he is the person who pulls the trigger. But he's also just clearly a goon or like an enforcer in that story. So,
yeah, you
know, maybe yeah. He was still on her list, but it didn't really seem to me like she seemed a little blindsided by the whole thing.
Yeah, I think it's possible that them going to Joker kind of pointed that out to her, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sal, and then I guess it seems like Councilman, what's his name?
Arthur Reeves.
He also seemed to know the connection with the Joker and Andrea, or at least with the mob. Like he knew who Joker was before he was the Joker. Mm. I don't know if he necessarily knows he was the one that killed Andrea's dad. Sorry, what was I going with that? But yeah, that is a good point. I could see like maybe she wasn't initially on his hit list. I don't know why maybe Arthur wasn't on the hit list, because he seemed to be kind of tied up in the mob too, and she was like dating him like kind of. But like obviously for nefarious reasons, but it did feel like a weird one to like exclude.
No, but when Joker meets with Arthur, he's like, you knew about all this, but also it's, you know, they clarify Arthur knew about it afterwards. Arthur was not involved
at the time. I see.
He was okay. Like he found out about everything because like Andrea's dad fled the country and then Arthur basically ended up dealing with Sal. So right. He was involved, but he was involved later.
Right, you're right. I forgot about that.
But yeah. I really love Joker as a side character.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I haven't seen him effectively used as a side character in a live-action Batman movie yet. Maybe the Batman 2 will do that, because I know that he's in it. But I really like him. Like the movie's not about Joker, but he's in there to... He specifically comes in and takes things in unexpected directions to where this, you know, without him... I think that the A plot of this movie is a pretty, you know, straightforward like mystery that certainly could resolve interestingly, but with Joker coming in to like throw a wrench in the works right at the end, it forces a lot of those emotional moments that I don't think would happen otherwise.
Yeah, I will say there's a lot of I don't know, like the Phantasm herself like is a very intimidating character, but and I mean maybe like they could have found a way to make a final showdown between her and Batman a little more interesting, but like it just doesn't make sense for Andrea and Bruce to fight like physically, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like to the death. Also having that parallel of, you know, Andrea is willing to do what Bruce can't, which is, you know, kill the Joker.
Yeah,
even though he doesn't die. So I don't really know what happens there. That's also kind of bothers me sometimes. I really wish they
explode, but non-lethally. Non-lethal right. Damage explosion.
But yeah, I wish that was more clear. But yeah, the kind of conflict of ideals, which usually is between, like, I mean, like a lot of the times is between Batman and the Joker. This time was kind of between Andrea and Bruce in terms of how far do you take vengeance? Are you willing to do whatever it takes? You know, like, and what is the end goal? Because I guess if you look at this movie non-canonically, I would say she probably did kill Joker. And, you know, at the end of the movie, she doesn't seem any happier than she was before. And, you know, and she clarifies to this guy who was trying to flirt with her on this cruise ship that she's alone and she doesn't seem like she sees any possibility for her to not be alone in the future.
Mm.
Any chance she had of that was taken the minute she
I guess, killed the Joker, I would say, and completed her revenge and, you know, realized that it didn't really give her any of the satisfaction or ability to move on that she thought it would. You know, in contrast to Bruce, who also can't move on, but he hasn't killed anyone. And I guess part of him feels a little more at peace with that. And like, I think what's interesting is it doesn't really tell you which one's actually better either, because I think they both end in pain, if that makes sense.
There's a final speech from Alfred where he says, "I've always respected about you, Bruce, that you've never, you know, jumped into that chasm of vengeance. But Andrea did that years ago." And I was hearing that and I'm like, I don't know, though. Bruce hasn't gone and killed anybody. But like, has he not also jumped into that same chasm of vengeance and like lost his entire life to this pursuit of vengeance the same way that she has? Like, how yeah. different are they really? And there's a good argument that they are still somewhat different, but I don't know. I don't know. It doesn't feel like they're that different.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like with Bruce, he's like, I'm doing all this for vengeance, but I'm not fully crazy because I don't kill anyone. Like, I have rules. It's like, yeah, well, I mean, but also, like, you're miserable. You're fighting crime at night and nothing's getting better. So what would you say?
You live in a mansion alone.
Yeah, it's like, what would you say about is any better than what she's doing? But I guess you could also argue that, like, with Andrea, she had a very set hit list, you know? There was an end to it. I think with Bruce, there's also this factor of like, there isn't really like a person or like a group or a main objective with him like fighting crime. So for him, killing is like, well, once he kills one person, it's like, well, just kill them all. There's no set conclusion to his quest.
But then, so there's also, I read a really good review of this one that maybe I'll link in the comments here. Or in the description here by a guy named Darren Moody, who I read a lot of reviews on of and then talk about on the podcast, I guess. One part that he points out is like, this is a story that kind of explores, can Batman ever be happy? And I do kind of wonder, like, with that, you know, Andrea has made her hit list, and when she is done with her hit list, the expectation, I'm sure, is that she'll be happy that it's over. And like, I don't know, maybe she's happy that it's over, but she does not seem very happy at the end. Like, the vengeance has not brought her happiness. So maybe it's an advantage for Bruce that he doesn't have an end goal in mind. So, you know, he can never find out if the vengeance has brought him happiness. Right. The thing is, along the way, he is consistently miserable. Like, is there ever a world where Batman can be happy? Apparently not, if there must also be a Batman in that world.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like in order for the story to continue to like we see Batman Beyond and Bruce is 70 or 80 years old and he's still like alone in a mansion and you know, like finding ways to fight crime even though he can't fully do it himself at this point. So yeah. And you know, in some ways I think that's always been kind of a flaw of, it's gonna sound mean, but like the comic book medium in terms of like, and in some ways like the superhero medium, you know, your hero always has to be in some kind of pain for the story to continue. I mean, that's any story. And, you know, that it does hurt in terms of like being able to see character growth. And something I do love about the Nolan trilogy is that it's very realistic in that he's only Batman for like, I think like a year and a half or something, maybe 2 years.
It feels a little longer than that, but yeah, not much.
Well, it's like, it's basically the streak between Batman Begins and The Dark Knight.
Oh, because he kind of stops after The Dark Knight. Like, The Dark Knight Rises, he hasn't really been Batman in a while.
Says he hasn't been Batman in 7 years, or he hasn't been spotted since the death of Harvey Dent. So, and maybe he was a little active afterwards, but it seems like he's mostly retired. And then, you know, he finds a way to move on with and I guess be happy with his life in some way, you know? And I do like that about that story. The Bruce Timm universe where Batman is miserable essentially until he's a very old man is kind of sad. But you know, and again, it does, I think it does further, I almost push forward the uniqueness of this story too, which is that like, this wasn't like a one, this was really was like, I guess in this universe, the one chance Bruce had, you know.
But it was taken from him. by the mob.
By the mob. By the Joker. That is kind of funny that the Joker, he doesn't even know it, but he's the one that actually like fully destroyed Bruce's life without knowing it. And he'll never know that either.
I mean, I think if he did know, he would love it. Like he doesn't care.
Yeah.
My only regret is that I couldn't destroy his life more.
But yeah, I think that's all. I mean, this review is almost as long as the movie at this point.
Yeah.
It's just such a cool movie. And I do think it's my personal favorite Batman movie. I think it has all the cool aspects of a Batman movie that I want. And it made me a lot more invested in Bruce Wayne, the character, and his backstory than I've ever really been otherwise. I don't think many other movies. Batman Begins does a pretty good job, but for the most part, Bruce's come up as Batman is largely, I've never really seen it as very interesting other than this. So yeah,
I was just thinking, because we are almost as long as the movie now, we've never done this before, but I know some other podcasts do it. We should like do a live commentary for a movie at some point.
Ooh,
that's an idea.
I mean, this would be a perfect movie to try it on because it's
like, actually, yeah,
70 minutes or something. I just think it's like, it doesn't feel like it feels, there's so much happens. Like, it's actually insane. I don't understand how this movie is able to effectively do so well. I feel like this packs in just as much plot and character work and amazing scenes as like The Dark Knight. And The Dark Knight is like, what, twice the length, if not even more.
It might be 2.5 hours.
Yeah. And like, that's just crazy to me. I don't, the amount of, I guess, plot efficiency that this, and it never feels rushed either.
No.
So like, it honestly blows my mind.
It's crazy that it, like, at 76 minutes, it feels like a slow burn. It doesn't feel slow, but like, it doesn't, it feels, it's very well paced.
Yeah. I mean, I've watched 2-hour Marvel movies and I'm like, nothing happened. Yeah. And I'm like, and then I'll be like, you know, I don't think a Marvel movie or superhero movie can be good unless it's longer than 2 hours. Cause I think you just need more time to really pace things out. And then I see a movie like this and I'm like, well, there's not really any excuse now, is there?
Yeah.
So yeah, this is a certified classic for me, and I really hope we see this adapted in the future in some way.
It was very, I haven't read it, but in 2021 the Phantasm made her comic book debut.
Oh, wow.
Inside of a run of Batman that similarly was dealing with the idea of, can Batman ever be happy? So I don't think it was an exact adaptation, but like, this idea has been reused at least. So I would recommend to you the run by Tom King, Batman and Catwoman, although with the caveat that I myself have not read it yet. So I can't recommend it from a place of having seen it, but I will tell you that there is some kind of adaptation of this same story.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Maybe I'll have to check. Part of me wants to check it out, but I'm also like, I don't know if you can do it better. Even though I just asked for an adaptation. So I don't know. I don't know what I want. I've always wanted this movie to be more widely like known, if that makes sense. So I guess a live action adaptation is something I've always hoped for. And as I said, I think Scarlett Johansson would actually be a great Andrea Beaumont. So I think that could line up well if that's the route they're going for.
Well, I mean, Batman, I'm very excited what the Batman Part 2 will be, because this movie itself is based very, very loosely on a comic book called Batman Year 2. So, you know, The Batman with Robert Pattinson was not based on Batman Year 1 exactly, but I think there was like a lot of elements lifted from it, and it was about Batman very early into his career. Batman Year 2 is about Batman early, but not quite that early into his career. It would be a natural way to adapt, like a natural thing to adapt for the Batman Part 2. And like, this is probably the best version of Batman Year 2. Because obviously it's not an exact adaptation, but like, it takes some great liberties with it and turns it into something way more interesting. And maybe this is something that could be very easily cannibalized into the Batman Part 2.
Oh, very cool. We'll have to see.
We'll talk about that when it comes out in 2035.
Well, it's been a little long, yeah. I don't know what they're doing.
Anyway, Peter, you got any last thoughts on Batman Mask of the Phantasm?
Certified classic. Go watch it. I guess you can't really watch it in theaters, but
I would watch this in theaters if a theater near
me. Well, yeah. Yes, 100%.
So if a theater near you is playing it, drop us a comment so that we can go see it.
Hell yeah.